Morning, everybody. On 88.1 WIPR, I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us for Maryland Morning. We begin with Howard County Executive Alan Kittleman for an update on recovery efforts in Ellicott City after the devastating flash flood that left two people dead, 200 buildings damaged or destroyed, and hundreds of cars strewn about the historic streets or thrown into the Patapsco River. Then, the culture connection with Dr. Sherry Parks. As the Olympics enters its final weekend, star gymnast Simone Biles and gold medal swimmer Simone Manuel are just two of several black athletes who have become household names. Corinne Gaines and Sylville Smith came to be well-known in recent days for tragic reasons. Has Rio changed the conversation about race? Then, Old Line Spirits is one of the latest entries in the crowded field of craft distilling. We'll take a sip of this new single malt. Bill Sandler has a Baltimore story first, the news.
I'm producer Rob Sivak. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Morning, everybody. Welcome on this beautiful Friday morning to Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. We're going to start today with Howard County Executive Alan Kittleman with an update on efforts to provide relief to business owners and residents affected by the flash flood that ransacked Ellicott City 3 weeks ago. In less than 2 hours on the last Saturday night in July, the Patapsco River rose 14 feet. A flash flood from streams that flow into the Patapsco coursed down Main Street, killing two people and inflicting heavy damage in the historic enclave that was founded 244 years ago. The State Board of Public Works announced yesterday that it was making $2.5 million available to assist small businesses and residents. There's more money in the pipeline that has been requested by Governor Hogan, and more than $500,000 has already been donated by individuals to a recovery fund. Howard County Executive Alan Kittleman joins me on the line. Good morning, sir, and thank you for your time. I know this is a very busy time for you.
Good morning, Tom. No, thank you for having me. It is a busy time, but we're making progress.
Let's talk first about access to the properties in Ellicott City. Starting right now at this hour, you're allowing folks to go back into their stores and their homes to retrieve stuff and to make plans. Tell us how that's going to work.
Well, it actually started yesterday. Again, we told the residents that we would give a five-day block here for them to be able to get in all day long. We've asked our Department of Public Works folks to kind of pull back a little bit. They can be working on some areas just on the peripheral of Main Street. But yesterday, the residents had a full day down there, and the businesses and the property owners, and they'll do the same for the next 4 days from 9 until 7 p.m., 9 a.m. to 7 p.m., and just gives them an opportunity to bring vehicles down now as well. We just wanted to make sure that we have people organized so not everybody's bringing a vehicle at the same time. So our folks here in Howard County have done a good job of kind of coordinating everything so people can get down there and get done what they need to get done. A lot of people have been cleaning up for a while now. We've had previous times where people have been able to get down there, and it's amazing how much work the residents and the business owners and property owners have been able to do with their friends and family and volunteers. So hopefully over the next 4 days, they'll get a chance to get everything else done they need to get done, and then we are going to be closing off Main Street so that we can get some major utility and critical infrastructure done for 3 weeks.
3 weeks, and you do plan to rebuild Ellicott City, is that right?
No question. And, you know, and it's not just me planning to rebuild. It's the community who wants to rebuild. It's the property owners who want to make sure that they rebuild their property and make it stronger and even better than before. So, you know, it's not a decision just that I, as county executive, get to make. This is a community decision, and we're all working together, and we're excited about the possibilities of having an even stronger Ellicott City and one that is, can maybe mitigate problems even better in the future.
There are some folks who say that perhaps that should be rethought, though, because this is the second big flood in just 5 years. There have been 11 events like this over the last few decades. This is clearly not going to be the last time that Ellicott City has to contend with a lot of water, given its geographical location. Does it make sense to try to prop it back up again if something like this is likely to happen in the future?
Oh, it definitely makes sense. Ellicott City is a treasure for Howard County and for Maryland, and you know, it's something that we don't want to lose. And, you know, I will just tell you that we've had disasters in the past that weren't even flooding. We've had a couple fires in Ellicott City, and when the buildings that were destroyed by the fires were rebuilt, those buildings had no problem with this most devastating flood we had, the flood that some call a thousand-year flood. And so it's amazing how well those buildings held up. It's just that if we can improve the buildings that are there now, there are a couple buildings that are going to have to be majorly rebuilt. We can make them stronger, and we can help them to be able to survive. You're not going to have a flood like we had very often. You have the floods that we generally have in Ellicott City are the ones where we have maybe 1 inch or 2 inches of rain in a short period of time. And that has caused problems in the past, nothing like this devastating flood. So I believe we can do the mitigation that's necessary, especially if we get some help from the federal government, to be able to make it so that Ellicott City can continue to flourish as a great town with a unique character that everyone loves so much.
Obviously, this incident has brought the issue of stormwater runoff to the fore, because a lot of folks point to the number of impervious surfaces in Ellicott City that contributed to the fact that the Tiber stream could overflow in such a dramatic fashion. Where does the county stand in terms of meeting its obligation to mediate 20% of impervious surfaces by 2019? This is what some folks in the Republican Party, which is your party, were calling the rain tax. The Governor Hogan's administration got rid of the requirement for jurisdictions, the large jurisdictions in Maryland, to impose a dedicated fee. Howard County chose to keep it. Where do things stand with that?
Well, I mean, the 20%, of course, is countywide, not just in the Ellicott City area. But I mean, we're working very hard on that. We're doing the best we can, and we'll, you know, go do as best we can to make that goal. Whether we make it or not, I know Montgomery County has not been able to make their goal that they put out previously. So we'll see what happens with that. But more importantly, I think the question about Ellicott City, we do have people saying things about the infrastructure and the development and impervious surfaces. And I will tell you that, you know, development since 2000, I believe, has been under new regulations, have been having to mitigate their own stormwater on their property. And so a lot of it, I think, is an issue of this was a rainstorm. This was a devastating flood that would have had a problem with any type of mitigation. I don't think anyone could have built something to withstand 6 inches of rain in 2 hours. That just wasn't possible. But we can work and do better. And when I got elected in 2014 and in December took office, myself as well as Councilman John Weinstein, who represents the Ellicott City area, we worked together to put together a flood mitigation work group. They worked for a year and a half, and they gave us recommendations just last December. Myself and the county council have put in about $4.3 million into our capital budget to start addressing some of those problems. And we were getting ready to start doing that because their recommendations, like I say, just came in last December. And, of course, we had this terrible storm. And so, you know, we're going to continue to work to mitigate, Tom, but we're also waiting to see if we do get federal funds, that might help us to be able to do more in a shorter time period.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. My guest this morning, Howard County Executive Alan Kittleman. We're talking about rebuilding and recovering from the floods in Ellicott City. There is some state money that has been made available, about $2.5 million so far, with another $2.5 million in the pipeline. Who does that money go to? How is it spent? What do you have to do to qualify for it?
Well, the Board of Public Works, we're very thankful to Governor Hogan and Comptroller Francho. I know Treasurer Kopp wasn't there. I think she would have supported it as well, so I'm not saying anything against her, but she wasn't there that day. That's $2.5 million is going to go to the Department of Housing and Community Development. They're going to use that $2.5 million to provide low interest or 0% loans. I think it's very low interest loans, maybe 1.6 or something I heard the other day. And so we'll be working with property owners as well as business owners to help them. And so it should be able to help everybody down in Main Street to help them either restock, or help them do some rebuilding, help do other things as well. So I'm very thankful to the Board of Public Works for doing that. But they also, Governor Hogan also the same day announced that he would be requesting $2.5 million from the state legislature from the Catastrophic Relief Fund. I know it has to go to the Legislative Policy Committee for that to be finalized. When I was a state senator, I actually had an opportunity to serve on that committee for a while when I was in leadership. And so I know that they'll be reviewing it as soon as possible. I'm sure they can try to get a meeting together very quickly. And so I'm confident they'll approve that. So then we'll have a total of $5 million. Still, all that will go through the Department of Housing and Community Development. And they'll be working with the residents and business and property owners of Ellicott City to see what's the best way to use that funds.
Assuming that second part of the funding is approved, do you think $5 million is going to be enough to do it?
I think it's a good start. Again, we're also looking at other funds that are available through different agencies, federal and state. And so we'll continue to look at that. We also are very appreciative of the outpouring of support that people have made for the Advocacy Partnership, the United Way, and other organizations, the Community Action Council of Howard County. They've raised, just in a couple of those organizations, over $500,000 alone. And so we're working, we have put a fund committee together to kind of look at applications and give recommendations on where maybe some of those funds should be spent. So we have a lot of different avenues we're looking at, Tom. And so I am very appreciative of Governor Hogan and Comptroller Franco in the state of Maryland for helping us with the $5 million to start with. And certainly there may be other ways. I had conversation with Secretary Gill from the Commerce Department yesterday. He's going to be looking at ways in which they can maybe help some of the business owners. I met with the Secretary of Transportation, working with different ways we can help with road improvements. And so there are a lot of different groups working together with us. And again, Governor Hogan has been great because he has really made clear that all of his cabinet secretaries should be doing all they can to work with us to solve whatever problems they can help us with.
Over the last 15 years or so, there are some folks that estimate that developers have made more than 100 proposals to build in and around Ellicott City. You know, these are residential areas, retail areas, office buildings. Many of these developments are near the Tiber Stream and the Hudson Stream that were the ones that overflowed to cause this, as you say, 1-in-1,000-year flood. Is the development of Howard County going to slow down or be affected in any way by this particular event?
Well, we're certainly going to continue to make sure that the regulations are followed. That's one thing that I ran on as my campaign. I know a lot of people are concerned in Howard County about growth and development, but you know, we certainly don't want to stop development. That certainly is something that's good for our county and it's good for our people of Howard County. So we just got to make sure it's done in a responsible way. And so that's been our job as county executives. I took office to make sure that the regulations we have are followed and that we make sure things are done well. With that being said, as I said earlier, stormwater regulations were increased dramatically in previous years so that whenever there's a development done, whether it be commercial or residential, they're required to mitigate the stormwater on site. And so any new development being done is certainly going to be carefully scrutinized to make sure that it does that. I don't know if the number you have is correct about how much has been requested over those years, but whatever development's been requested, we are making sure that every regulation in Howard County is followed.
Alan Kettleman is the county executive of Howard County. If you'd like to help relief efforts or if you need more information about the services that are being offered by various agencies, come to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and we'll provide a link. County executive, thank you so much, sir. I appreciate it.
I really appreciate it, Tom, and thank you for everyone's support for Ellicott City. It means an awful lot.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
By the way, Toby's Dinner Theater of Columbia is producing a series of late-night cabaret performances to benefit the Ellicott City Partnership Relief Fund. It's called the Main Thing Cabaret Series, and the first performance is tonight following their performance of their current production, Hairspray. There are other cabaret performances scheduled in the coming weeks. We'll have more information about all that as well on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. It is Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up after a break to the news, Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks from the University of Maryland. We'll talk about race and the Rio Olympics. Stay with us.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Thanks, Nathan, and welcome back. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. It's the final weekend of the Olympics. Black athletes have been particularly significant to the storylines in Rio, from Simone Biles' record-tying 4 gold medals to Simone Manuel's precedent-breaking gold and silver medals in swimming. Brianna Rollins, Nia Ali, and Christy Caslin captured the first-ever medal sweep in the 100-meter hurdles, and Ashley Johnson is the standout goalie as the women's water polo team heads into the gold medal game today against Italy. How do the achievements of these gifted young people inform the larger implications for the conversation about race in America? Let's take up that question in this edition of Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks. She's an Associate Dean for Research, Interdisciplinary Scholarship and Programming at the College of Arts and Humanities at the University of Maryland College Park, where she's also an Associate Professor in the Department of American Studies, and she's the author of Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. Morning, Sherry. Good to see you.
Good morning. Good to see you.
So before we take up the Olympics, you live in Oella. We were just talking Howard County Executive Alan Kittleman. You were right next to this devastation.
Yeah, the next street over on another hill. So we were quite safe. But it is really, for us, a statement about place and space, because, I mean, the people in my office start hinting for chocolates from Sweet Cascades in October, because I buy the chocolate turtles, and my wedding reception was at Coco Lane. And so it was interesting to hear you ask the question about, well, why rebuild it? And the answer was very emotional. And it is a very special place. All the shops are non-essential, meaning that, you know, nobody lives or dies based on the products that are there. Mm-hmm. But it really is, in some ways, the heart of that little region there.
Yeah, but you got to wonder, though, with this repeated devastation that happens, you know, sort of every few years, so I think there's growing concern that, does it make sense to rebuild what was there, or, you know, redevelop that area into some other kind of thing, just because the floods are just, you know, sort of part and parcel of what that area is about.
Well, for me, it brings home, literally brings home, this question about global warming, because we're going to get more and more of those. And I'm watching the news stories in New Orleans and other Baton Rouge and other places, knowing that we've got to figure out what to do with our relationship with water.
Yeah.
And this is our conversation in Maryland.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's quite a conversation. And, of course, you know, what's going on over there is, you know, caught the attention of the entire country, for sure. And then it's followed up with, you know, what's going on now in Baton Rouge. But let's move to the Olympics. The coverage of the games is actually drawing smaller audiences in terms of the TV audiences than it has in the past, although they're still wiping out all the other networks while they're on. But it's because people are watching in podcasts and stuff. But it does seem that an awful lot of people are seeing an incredible array of terrific African-American athletes doing just amazing things, and sometimes doing things in sports that they're not normally associated with, fencing and mm-hmm. swimming and, you know, stuff like that. What has this changed, do you think, or will it change the way we talk about race in America, given that this is such a central event?
Well, I think they are exploding some myths about black bodies, some things that were considered truisms. Black people can't swim, they'll sink, which is still floating around out there if you watch what's going on social media. And so winning gold medals kind of explodes that. And fencing, I should say truth, and I fenced for Chapel Hill in undergraduate.
Yes.
So I was one of the few black people out there. But so watching people win in fencing has been particularly wonderful. But I also think, in terms of that, I mean, you've got your first, and you're going to continue to get your first in that. In many cases, the swimming and the fencing are statements about social class. I mean, who now has access to pools? I have my roommate at Chapel Hill's father, who is African American, his father died by drowning. And African Americans actually
in a pool.
Do die more in drowning. But because of that, she made sure in her upper middle class life that all of her children went to swimming lessons, joined a pool, because often that's where the best coaches are. And her son is a good enough swimmer that he actually swam for Chapel Hill.
Wow.
So it's not body mass, it's social class. But the other thing that is happening, you know, the Olympics are an exercise in nationalism. I mean, you fly the flag, and athletes are draped in the American flag when they win. And we've seen an awful lot of that, of African Americans draped in the American flag. You know, the women's 100-meter hurdles.
Yeah, all three of them. That gold of them, medal, gold, silver, and bronze. Terrific.
Jumping in the air with their flags, and so they're literally flying the flag. And it's very interesting that they have been embraced, at least for now, because of that.
Simone Biles.
Yes.
It's just this singular phenomenon came in, and everybody really just assumed she would win all five gold medals mm-hmm. in all five events that she entered. That turned out not to be quite the case, but she won the bronze medal on the balance beam, even though she had a slip.
Yeah, so her score was so high.
It was that good that you could even just sort of, you know, right. have a crash and burn moment for most people, and she wins a bronze medal.
And that was the dramatic moment, is that she didn't win the gold.
Yeah, yeah. What happens with a figure like that? I mean, she's obviously turned pro. She's getting some endorsements. I suppose perhaps will the number and dollar amount of the endorsements that she takes in, will that be an indication of her acceptance? And I wonder if that will indicate some, you know, some increased empathy for African Americans or increased affection.
Two interesting questions in there. There's a two-step process, maybe, because the endorsements are not a direct indication. They are a direct indication of the corporate anticipation of her acceptance. And so there's a step, and sometimes they miss and sometimes they hit. And I have to say that traditionally African-American athletes get fewer endorsements and for less money than other athletes. And so that has been the case. Whether she transcends that, we will see. She transcends racialism in some ways, you know, her big, very publicized crush on Zac Efron and the hug and all of that already transcends. She's very perky. She doesn't act in or speak in ways that many people in America would perceive as stereotypically black. Whether that lasts over time, her popularity is interesting, because gymnasts are a particular breed in terms of their appeal to the public. So there's race, there's her African-Americanism. I think if anybody has a chance, she does, because she's so, and I'm going to use this word, and it's loaded, exceptional, because there is the danger of stepping into the exceptional Negro category of it's just her.
Hmm. Yeah, so she is such a singular figure that it is not indicative by any means. Yeah,
well,
interesting.
The word that follows her often is superhuman, that she's not quite of us. And so that way she's not of, she may not be seen as representing black people.
For all of these athletes, Simone Biles, Simone Manuel, this incredible swimmer, Ashley Johnson, this goalie for the water polo team, she's incredible. I wonder how our understanding and appreciation of their accomplishments is going to be understood in light of the fact that we had four white swimmers just yesterday be exposed as complete creeps.
Well,
Ryan Lochte et al. Making up stories, indicting the security situation in Rio to cover up boorish actions of their own.
Well, the Root, which is an arm of the Washington Post, has already run a story saying that was an exercise in white privilege, of them feeling that they could behave any way they wanted to in this majority black country. And I think I'm sorry that story has pushed off the happier stories. I mean, we in Maryland have lots of happy Olympic stories. I mean, Maryland did really well.
Yeah.
And is still doing really well. And so I think that the fact that story can push their story off is indicative of how the media is going to handle it. I mean, what are you going to remember longer? And that story is going to have legs, because it's not over yet.
Yeah. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. It's our Culture Connections segment with Dr. Sherry Parks from the University of Maryland. You wrote a terrific book called Fierce Angels, about strong black women. This has been about strong black women, hasn't it?
Well, and that is how the women are being portrayed. I mean, Simone Biles, there's already a Tide commercial that has her, you know, kind of conquering her environment all over the place. And the way the goalie has been described as exploding out of the goalpost. And so there's lots of indication. You know, with Simone Manuel, it was very interesting, because nobody was talking about her during the competition. I kept saying, that black woman over on the side seems to be swimming faster than the other people, but the commentators didn't say anything until she actually won. And so now she's the champion.
Yeah.
Before, they were talking about everybody else. But certainly over and over, this idea of black women as stronger it has been throughout the Olympics. Now, Simone is interesting because she's strong and little and perky.
She's the whole package, isn't she? Yeah.
You know, and so I think the image of black women who are strong and is a very interesting one for the Olympics.
Gabby Douglas, who many people felt just awful for. She's a defending gold medal champion from the London Olympics, not even allowed to compete in the all-around event. I mean, just because she didn't make the cut this year. 4 years can be a lifetime, I suppose, in the sport of gymnasts. But she's been widely criticized for a brief moment in which she did not choose to place her hand over her heart during the playing of the national anthem. What do you make
and
of that?
When did the rule that you had to put your hand over your heart come? And actually, the women's hurdle team, none of them put their hands over their heart, and I haven't heard any backlash about that. Gabby Douglas was in a very difficult situation in that she's still quite good. And the U.S. gymnastics team is so good that we left people at home that would have beat many of the other teams. And so her being just the third one meant that she was still better than a lot of the people that she had to sit and watch. That's tough.
Yeah.
That's very tough. And I think she handled it the best way a 20-year-old could have handled it. She was there. She smiled as much as she could. I mean, was she jumping up and down as much as other people? No. Unfortunately, Krabby rhymes with Gabby.
Yeah. She was, you know, the sort of Simone Biles of the London Olympics in a way, but she and they do share some things, but Simone Biles is a different personality than Gabby Douglas. Gabby's always been a little more introspective, a little quieter, it seems to me.
Well, and Simone comes from more privilege than Gabby, and that I think is really important. She acts in ways that mainstream America can understand. The follow-up act, and you know this as a performer, the follow-up act after a hit is always the hardest.
Yeah, indeed. Let's talk about Simone Biles' background. I mean, it was privileged at some point, but early on, it certainly was not.
Right.
And how does that play into the narrative of how we understand
it? Well, you know, we always love up-from stories, and at first, we didn't know the story about her mother and her behavior, and that Simone and her sister were given to her grandfather to raise, and he's where the privilege comes in, and the education and even the homeschooling, which requires a certain amount of leisure to homeschool a child so she can be a gymnast. And so, but then that just only adds because she's already overcome that background. She's already heroic. And so it adds to the story because we love those up from poverty, up from suffering stories.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. My guest, Dr. Sherry Parks. It's our Culture Connections segment. Last night, another precedent-breaking gentleman left the airwaves, Larry Wilmore, who started as the host of The Nightly Show, which was replacing Stephen Colbert's show when he departed Comedy Central to go and take over Letterman's spot on CBS. They sort of abruptly canceled him. He was, at that time, the first African-American late-night host. He was the oldest of the crop of late-night hosts. I did not see the episode last night, but what do you make of Larry Wilmore's tenure at Comedy Central, and what does it mean that he had that position, and what does it mean that he does not have that position now, for whatever their reasons were?
Well, first we have to remember Arsenio Hall.
Arsenio Hall, right.
So he wasn't the first, but he's the first in a long time and the only. Late night is a very interesting television relationship. People are starting to go to bed. They have a relationship with that guy that comes on every night before they go to bed. You can be funny and you can be edgy, but you also have to be warm. He's not warm. And so here was this intelligent, hard-hitting black guy.
Let's listen to a little clip from last night's show, the last episode of Nightly with Larry Wilmore, and his guest was Jon Stewart.
You gave voice to underserved voices in the media arena. You started a conversation that was not on television when you began, and you worked with a group of people who you invited to that conversation to collaborate with you, to sharpen that conversation, and what you don't realize is you walk out of this room and that conversation doesn't end.
We can hope, you know.
And I'm really,
we can hope that conversation doesn't end, but I wonder, you know, once you take the African-American out of the host seat, it doesn't help the conversation.
Well, I'm really glad that you ran that clip because I think Jon Stewart has a point that you may not see it as hard-hitting, but television often imitates itself. And so there's been this process where there was this hard-hitting show, then there was the White House Correspondents' Dinner that introduced him to a broader audience. His audience really should be younger than I think he hits. And those people don't.
And that's the reason they're giving for canceling him, is that it wasn't resonating with our audience,
right,
which tends to be younger males. I wonder if they're mostly white males. I don't know.
Well, that's who Jon Stewart's audience is.
Yeah.
But I think television will then come and imitate parts of it in a looser, lighter way. And so it may reverberate. I think that's what Jon Stewart's talking about. It may reverberate that way. I don't think anybody's going to dare to come back as and hit as hard as he did. I have very mixed feelings about him, actually.
White House correspondent, you know, we just got a few seconds left. He dropped the N-word in a loving way to President Obama. Do you think that kind of, you know, really on-the-edge performance affected people's understanding and appreciation of him on television on a regular basis?
Yes. I think it eclipsed some of his stronger, more truthful messages.
Yeah, interesting. Well, Sherry, always good to see you. We shall see you the next time.
Okay.
Dr. Sherry Parks is an Associate Dean for Research Interdisciplinary Scholarship. I can't say that we're going to. Interdisciplinary Scholarship. I'm glad I don't have your calling card, and programming at the College of Arts and Humanities at the University of Maryland College Park. She's also an associate professor in the Department of American Studies. She's the author of Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. Coming up after a break for the news, a new whiskey has made its way to the shelves of local spirit shops. It's made by two new whiskey wizards. We'll meet them coming up later on Maryland Morning.
Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We're at Maryland Morning. Now back to the show.
Welcome back. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. More than a dozen new distilleries have opened or are set to open across Maryland. Last year, Baltimore Magazine described it as a spirit-making tsunami. Well, here in Baltimore, four craft distilleries have fired up whiskey stills in just the past few years. If this trend continues, Maryland could return to its pre-prohibition status as the country's third biggest whiskey maker after Kentucky and Pennsylvania. My next guests are two guys who are making a run at this booming booze market. Mark McLaughlin and Arch Watkins are friends who met while serving as flight officers in the Navy. They founded Old Line Spirits in 2014, and they're putting the finishing touches on their refurbished distillery in Highlandtown, which they plan to have up and running sometime in the early fall. Welcome to both of you. It's good to see you.
Likewise. Thank you.
So, Mark, you were an investment banker, and Arch was an engineer or something. How did you end up in the whiskey business?
So, like you mentioned on the intro, Arch and I are Navy buddies. We both got out for different reasons and both ended up in Baltimore. I'm not from here originally. I'm from Boston, but fell in love with the city and haven't looked back. Got into investment banking, which was a great place to learn a lot, but I realized pretty quickly it wasn't what I wanted to do long term. This has always been kind of been nagging at me, the desire to own my own business, to be in the spirits industry. It's always been something that's very interesting to both of us, I think. And at a certain point, I just decided that, you know, I wasn't getting any younger, and we decided to just jump in with both feet and start a business, and there you go. It was as simple as that.
And you actually bought this. This was a business that existed before. I mean, the recipe for this brew has existed before. Do I have that right? You met somebody who was also had a Navy connection out in the Pacific Northwest?
That's correct, yeah. We met two older gentlemen. They were both Vietnam-era veterans, and they had an award-winning whiskey that they wanted to keep alive and pass down. They were ready to retire. They're in their 70s. One of them was terminally ill. And actually, Mark ran into one of them at a conference. And we got to know them, got to know the product a lot better. Went out there and apprenticed under one of them for a couple of months. Learned everything about the product. And we packed everything up and moved it to Baltimore.
All right. And then you'll be up and running in Highlandtown pretty soon, I
Absolutely,
guess.
Absolutely, yeah.
So how would you describe this particular whiskey, Mark?
So it's a relatively new category. It's an American single malt. So similar to a single malt scotch, it's made from 100% malted barley. Ours is all grown and malted in the U.S. But unlike a scotch, we age it in brand new barrels. So fresh charred oak barrels, which is the way you age a bourbon. So essentially, we're taking the basic idea behind a scotch, but putting an American spin on it. So it's you can call it a hybrid of scotch and bourbon. We think it leans more towards a bourbon because of that oak forward flavor that you get from those fresh new barrels.
Uh-huh. So I'm going to take a sip here. We've each got one a little bit, called here. So cheers, salut. And of course, we're doing this. You know, a friend of mine once said drinking before breakfast has been much maligned. But
yeah.
here it is. It's not quite before breakfast, but it's early. Yeah, that's very smooth. I enjoy scotch. I enjoy bourbon, but I'm not an aficionado. Arch, what should one be looking for when one tastes a new concoction like this?
Typically, you start out with getting the nose, you know, sticking your nose in there and getting the aroma off of the whiskey. And that's going to tell you a lot about what you're going to taste. My nose, I smell a little bit of honey, some vanilla, maybe a little bit of banana hidden in there. And then when I taste it, the sweet receptors on the tip of your tongue will pick up all those sweet notes. And then, you know, towards the middle of the palate, we'll have a little bit more, you'll taste the malt, the single malt come through in a way you wouldn't really see with a bourbon.
Yeah, but this really doesn't taste like any bourbon I've ever had, nor does it taste like any scotch I've ever had. So I can see how you say it's kind of a hybrid.
Yeah,
it's interesting. Yeah.
And we like that because what it does for us is, A, we love the product and the flavor profile, but also as far as when we go out there and introduce it to people, you know, it's not one more of something they already, you know, if somebody already has 10 bourbons on a shelf at home, does he need one more? Maybe not. But this is something that's familiar, but still different enough to really get people's attention, which mm-hmm. we really like.
I mean, as we mentioned at the top, so many people are opening these distilleries now. I mean, Kevin Plank, very famously, the owner of Under Armour, he has a thing called Sagamore Spirits. I mean, obviously, you guys have checked this out. I mean, you think there's enough demand to be able to, you know, accommodate all of these different businesses?
Oh, I think so.
It sounds like they have a lot of competition. That's what I'm saying.
I think that if you look back, we haven't even approached the number of distilleries that were around pre-prohibition. I think that the and of course there's that many more people that are drinking whiskey now, so I think there's a ton of headroom. Certainly Baltimore, DC, Annapolis, this area here is very, very thirsty. We haven't had a problem getting our product on the shelf at all.
Yeah, so there are more people drinking whiskey now. Why do you think there's been a renaissance of whiskey drinking all of a sudden?
You know, we kick it around all the time.
We're past the Chardonnay phase of our,
sure.
You know, culture.
I think it's, I've heard it described a couple of ways, and the ones that resonated with me the most were really two reasons. One, that it's not coming from nowhere. It's that it was, you know, a much more popular drink years ago, and then vodka took over in the 70s and 80s, really. And people are just getting back into it now. And also, I've heard people describe it as just in general a reset to flavor in the American palate. So not just with whiskey, but with beer and with food. I mean, if you walk around Baltimore, I would guess you can probably find more really good meals today than you could maybe 30, 40 years ago.
That's certainly the case.
And I think that's just part of that broader trend where people are just rediscovering flavor on every level, and this is just one more expression of that.
Mm-hmm. And how long is the process? So, in other words, people can buy old line American whiskey now in, you know, liquor stores here in Maryland, but none of that was made in Baltimore. That's the stuff that was made in the original distillery back in at the Pacific Northwest. So, how long will it take for people to be able to buy old line that's actually produced here from Baltimore?
Well, we hope to have our still up and running, like you said, in the early fall. And depending on how long it takes to age in our small oak casks, hopefully a year.
What's the normal aging? About a year?
About a year, yeah. Mm-hmm. Until then, Mark and I went out there and we made it, made a good deal of it when we were apprenticing. And that'll be ready shortly as well. I can't say it went offhand right now, but...
Because that was a while ago, that's towards the end of its process.
Yeah, right.
I understand that the American Distilling Institute is going to have its annual conference here in Baltimore in April. That's another feather in the cap of Baltimore distillers, isn't it? That's
sure.
A big deal to have all those folks come.
I think so. It is. Yeah, we're excited about that. And we actually were just talking about this earlier with us and then the other members of the Maryland Distilling Guild. You know, we all work together on a lot of things, and we all get along really well. So we're all trying to wrap our heads around how we can, you know, all participate.
Sounds like a nice community of folks.
Oh, absolutely.
All right. Well, good luck to you. This tastes great to me, and I'm sure it would taste better if it were 5 o'clock in the afternoon instead of, you know, 10 o'clock in the morning. But it's great to meet you, and best wishes. Okay.
Likewise.
Mark McLaughlin and Arch Watkins are co-founders and owners of Old Line Spirits Distillery in Highlandtown. They're set to debut their new line of whiskey. Made here in Baltimore sometime in the early fall. They are one of the latest in a wave of new distilleries to open up in Baltimore and across the state. More information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Maryland Morning's director, engineer, and co-host is Nathan Sterner. The show's produced by Rob Sivak, Bridget Armstrong, and Kathleen Cahill, with production assistance from Lauren Ferguson. Austin Coughlin from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the Maryland Morning theme music. Coffee for our guests provided by Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville. You can find them online at zekescoffee.com. That's our show for this morning. Coming up Monday, a conversation with MICA President Sammy Hoy, a theater review with J. Wynn Russick, and activist and author Steve Phillips on a new American majority. Hope you can join us Monday morning here on Maryland Morning. Until then, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for listening. Garrison Keillor's up next. Have a great weekend.
I'm going to try to get you some whiskey. I want you to have a very fine time. If I can't get you scotch and bourbon, Lord, I sure ain't gonna offer you no wine. Whoa, Sam Hopkins, I'm so glad you in my town.